Good morning. I think I'll just get started since I'm not really sure how long this will take. Hopefully we can get to lunch at a reasonable time. That's an ominous way, right? So this morning I will talk about deep earth mineralogy. And as I was finishing this up, I realized that, well, you'll see. we'll see how it goes, and please stop me when you know, if you have any questions. Hopefully this is at a level that is, actually it's probably at a level that's really easy, but maybe, hopefully for those of you who are specialists, we'll learn something new, and for those of you who don't have a lot of background in mineral physics, hopefully it's easy enough to follow. Okay, so we're going to start off with the periodic table. And if this were one of my freshman seminar courses, I would be giving everyone out their own copy of the periodic table. And I have several in my desk, in my backpack, and so forth. It's something that I like to carry around, which is, I don't have one in my pocket, but I do have pocket-sized ones. So anyway, here's just the periodic table. And these are all of the elements that we know and love. And how do we go from here to making the minerals that we also know and love, or will come to know and love, right? So we have, and this is just one particular model of the Earth. This one from several years ago by Bill McDonough. And what's shown here is the elemental composition of the Earth. So in the left-hand side, it's in weight percent. On the right-hand side, it's by mole, or by atoms. And so for the first column in each, first column of numbers on each side would be the whole Earth values. Now, as we heard from Sujoy's lecture yesterday, he won't even be able to tell us, like, you know, what flavor of chondrite we are, or mixture of chondrites and so forth. But given a bunch of assumptions as well as geophysical measurements that is based on what we know about the density of the Earth, this is a decent enough compilation of the elemental abundance in the Earth. No, I should say the major and minor elements, no trace elements here. So we have the Earth here, the whole Earth, and then it's broken down into the silicate part, the mantle, as well as the core. The crust isn't pulled out specifically in here, and that would be different from the mantle, but because it's such a small volume of the whole Earth, we'll just sort of tie it all in with the mantle. Okay. So some of the things that are noticeable and shouldn't be too surprising is the, does this work? No. Oh, maybe it's, yeah, there you go, it was off. So iron by weight is the most abundant element in the Earth, and certainly within the core, and then that's followed closely by oxygen for the whole Earth. This is certainly not surprising that oxygen would be, after iron, the most abundant by mass, considering that just about every rock we know of has got some oxygen in it. So so most of this oxygen, of course, is tied up in minerals and not what you're breathing now. Okay. So if we just look at the differences between the mantle and the core, you see that there are significant differences between the two, and that just goes to show the metallic nature of the core as compared to the more oxide silicate nature of the mantle. But how do these elements bond together to produce the minerals. Okay, so this is a xenolith. So this is a rock that has come from depth, approximately 100 plus kilometers depth. This is a garnet larizolite. Okay, and if you can see, these are the same. So we've got some garnet here, and we've got some pyroxene in the really bright green, and in sort of the darker greens, olivine and orthopyroxene. Now so with that rock though looks very different from sort of the typical rock that you might find if you were to pick something up off the ground just outside here, and what's present up here in the upper part of the mantle. So here is a simplified mineralogy of the Earth. And this is basically based on kind of a pyrolite or pyritotite type composition. So we've got olivine, pyroxenes, and garnet up here at the top. There are some phase transitions that turn these olivines into your ringwoodite and wadsteite, and your aluminum-bearing minerals such as majorite. And then as you go further down deep into the planet, we have bridgmanite and ferropericlase, which I spoke a lot about yesterday. Bridgmanite is the most abundant mineral in the Earth, followed by ferropericlase. This is a product of the breakdown of olivine. Okay, so the olivine that we see here, which makes up most of this rock, okay, eventually turns into bridgmanite and ferropericlase with sufficient pressure and temperature, and that roughly corresponds to the 660 or 670 kilometer discontinuity that we see seismically. We can show this in another way. So this basically shows the same thing that I had in the cross section. So we've got depth, so the surface is here and going down to the core mantle boundary. Okay, so we've got our olivine, pyroxenes, and garnets up here on top. The olivine turns into wadsteite and ringwoodite in the transition zone, and then those then go into bridgmanite here, ferropericlase, and the calcium silicate perovskite. As we go further down near the core mantle boundary, then we have an additional phase transition into the post-perovskite structure that I'll talk more about later and that I mentioned yesterday. So this is the one that had been discovered back in 2004, right before our first CIDR meeting. Okay, so again, how do we get all of these? So let's go back to kind of the fundamental principles and how do these elements bond. Okay, so let's look at the electron configuration for these elements, and that will then lead us to be able to put them together and assemble our minerals. Apologize for the wordy slide. Let's go through it. So I'm going to be giving you a bunch of so-called rules. Okay, so we have first we have Hund's rules, and this is going to dictate to us how we place our elements, our electrons, excuse me, in their various energy levels. Okay, so for instance, in our, I have it on the next slide, no, in a couple of slides. So if we have, there are S electrons, there are P electrons, there are D electrons, there are F electrons, but for the elements that we care most about, the major elements, we only need to worry about S, P, and D electrons. Okay, and so Hund's rules state that for every energy level for these electrons, you are going to have to assign each electron singly. So we put one electron in each energy level until we run out of energy levels, and then we can start again from the bottom. Okay. And when you start doubling up those electrons, okay, those electrons then will have to have different spin. Okay, they'll have to have, one will have a spin up, one will have a spin down. Now this is due to the Pauli exclusion principle. That is a principle that is more general for fermions, but we're talking about electrons. Electrons are fermions, so fermions are are particles that have a spin of plus or minus half. Okay. Here are the quantum numbers that we're going to worry about. So there are four quantum numbers. There's the principal quantum number. Okay. There's L for the angular momentum quantum number, the magnetic quantum number, ML, and the spin quantum number. So this is the plus or minus half that each of our electrons will have a value of. Okay. So if we are, so for these orbitals, so for these sp and d orbitals, this tells us the shape of the electron density that these electrons can sort of move around the atom, move around the nucleus. Okay. So the spherical, a spherical orbital, the s orbital is a spherical orbital, so you can think of it as sort of going around your nucleus in a spherical pattern. The p orbitals are more lobed, as well as the d orbitals. I'll have some pictures coming up shortly to show those. Okay. So depending on the element that we are going to be looking at, it's each of those electrons are going to have their own set of quantum numbers. And because of the Pauli exclusion principle, you can't have the same electron that has the same set of quantum numbers sitting in the same place. Okay, they can't occupy the same space. Okay. So, all right. So let's take an example, or a few examples. Okay, so we're going to take the elements that are most important for earth-forming minerals. So we have oxygen, silicon, magnesium, and iron. So they have a Z, their atomic number, and this is just their position in the periodic table. So oxygen is element 8, silicon is 14, magnesium is 12, iron is element 26. This tells you how many protons each of these elements have. Now, their electron configuration are shown here. Okay, so oxygen has a pair of 1s electrons, a pair of 2s electrons, and four 2p electrons. Excuse me. And its corresponding size, or the ionic radius, is shown here. And I've drawn them for each of the rest of these examples. Okay. So as you go to higher Z or more protons, in order to balance off that charge of the protons, so protons have positive charge, we're going to need some electrons, which is why as we increase Z, we'll also increase the number of electrons. Okay, so if you add up all of the superscripts here, so the 2, 2, 6, 2, 2, that should equal 14. Okay, so these are neutral. These are neutral atoms. Any questions on that part yet? Okay. So I show here the size, and I try to draw this to best scale that I could. Okay. So these are the ionic radii at sort of normal conditions. And as we'll learn throughout the rest of this lecture, we can influence this size. Right? And this will become important when we talk about how these elements are packed into each of our crystal structures, into each of our minerals. Okay, so let's look at how these ionic radii vary with atomic number, with Z. Okay, so we start off here with low Z values, and as we increase to higher Z values, here we have oxygen with a rather large ionic radii. Then it drops down, magnesium, aluminum, silicon. Then it jumps back up for chlorine, falls back down, up a little bit here for iron. Note that this is iron in the high spin state. I'll come back to that later. I did mention that yesterday, so I do want to point it out. Okay. And then it jumps back up here in selenium. What's going on here? Anyone have any ideas of why such the varied the variety of ionic radii? And what is it? What do you think it's from? Do we have the mic? Or yeah, go ahead.
Well, the ones with the large radii have more valence electrons in there,
which creates repulsion, so it creates a larger radius.
So we have repulsion. So we learned from our freshman physics class, right, with Coulomb repulsion and Coulomb attraction. And so when we have lots of like charges, they'll want to push apart from each other. If they're unlike charges, then they will tend to attract.
Okay. Yeah, and silicon has a high positive charge, so it likes to attract, pull in its electrons to its center, so it has a smaller radius.
Good. Great. Any other patterns you see here? Okay, so we can what you might see is sort of this kind of up and down, right? And this goes along with the idea that you've got sort of more, in comparison between magnesium and silicon, there are more protons available, okay, so to kind of attract. And so it'll tend to contract your ionic radii. Now we can also look on this side, which shows the same kind of thing, but now we're going to be looking at how charge affects the size of these ions or atoms. Okay, so what was shown here are the, you can see that, you know, the Mg2 plus or O2 minus or aluminum 3 plus, iron 2 plus. Okay, how does that compare to say just the neutral atoms? Okay, so in red for these ones that are in red, that shows the size of the cations, okay, as compared to their neutral state. So their neutral state compared to these cations, their neutral state is always a little bit larger. Okay? And that holds true as we go down the periodic table and across. Okay? Now, if we jump over to the other side of the periodic table, right? So here in the blue, okay, so these are our anions, okay? The anions here are shown in blue, and that shows the relative size of those radii as compared to their neutral versions of themselves. Okay, so it's opposite. Here the neutral versions of themselves are smaller than the ones that are their ionic versions. Okay. And within that too, as you move towards the right on the periodic table, they tend to decrease in size. Okay, and that's because you're adding more protons, as was mentioned earlier. Now, as we go down the periodic table, right, our ionic radii tend to increase with each row. Okay, so this lithium to fluorine row, that's the second row up here. Okay, so then we have the sodium row, that's the third row. Potassium, that's this one here. And then rubidium is the rubidium row here corresponds to this one. Okay, so as we add more shells of electrons and more protons, or more shells of electrons, we can get larger radii in general, but then as we add more protons heading to the right, they get smaller. Oh, and the just for completeness, so this here is the size of the iron 2 plus in a high spin state as compared to its low spin state. And you see there's a drop in the ionic radius. Okay. Why does that happen? Okay, because if you remember what I spoke about yesterday, that this spin transition can have quite a large effect on many physical properties, transport properties, chemical properties in terms of partitioning and so forth, at least what we've seen experimentally. So must have to do something with this ionic radius, because after all, it's the electrons that are doing the bonding. Okay, when we're forming materials, it's the electrons that take that into play. Okay, so let's look at how these electrons are working. So what I'm showing here is just this goes on much further, but I chopped it off to where it's most interesting for us. Okay, so we have the principal quantum number here. This is n. For n equals 1, we just have the 1s electron orbitals. Okay, with 2, we have the 2s and the 2p, 3, 3s, 3p, 3d, 4, and so forth. The scale on the vertical axis is energy. So the lower it is, the lower energy it is. Okay. And so as we increase n, in general, the energies increase. Right? Okay, so now let's look at, so since we're going to talk about the spin transition explicitly, let's look at these 3D electrons, these 3D orbital electrons, because this is where the spin transition occurs for iron. Okay. So in the 3D orbital, you'll notice that there are 5 different lines here. That represents 5 times 2 or 10 different electrons that are possible. Right? In your d states, you have 10 electrons. So if you had a full 10 electrons in your 3D state, you would have a spin up electron and a spin down electron on every single one of these. Now iron 2 plus, doesn't have a full 10 electrons. It only has 6. Okay? So now we have to follow Hund's rules. Okay? And divvy up those electrons amongst the 5 various orbital energy levels. Now, when it's shown here, they look like they're all at the same energy, and in fact, they are. It's not until you actually put that iron into a crystal that you start seeing these energy levels split. Okay? So this is what's called crystal field splitting. Maybe you might have heard that term used at some point. So we can take those 10 electrons and we can split it up, okay, and these two, depending on the form of that crystal, whether it's cubic, tetragonal, or orthorhombic, okay, it will be split up into these various energy levels. And so you see here so I'll just show here at the end, you have 5 of those different energy levels with 2 that can hold 2 electrons each, right? A spin up and a spin down. So now let's just take those. Yeah.
Does that mean that for all elements with incomplete d orbitals, you can have high spin and low spin versions?
There are, yeah. So you can get a spin transition. Iron is not the only one that can do a spin transition.
But we only care about iron because it's the main rock forming
because
element.
Because it's the most interesting one for the Earth. Yes. Okay, so here we have those 5, those same 5 energy levels, and in the high spin version, we take those 6 electrons and we first assign them one by one to each of the levels. So we've got a spin up, 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 There's one more left over, so that goes here as a spin down. Okay, so there are two different electrons that are occupying the same space. Great. Now, what happens, though, is we increase pressure. You'll note that these energy levels have shifted a bit, right? So we have increasing pressure this way and increasing energy this way. So it turns out, this is something that we've known for a long time, right? Nature wants to do things that take the least amount of energy. We like to do things that take the least amount of energy, okay? So what happens is as we increase pressure, it becomes more favorable for these six electrons to, rather than be set up this way, okay, it costs less energy to pair them up in the lowest energy states. Okay, so now we have an up, a spin up, a spin up, a spin up, and a spin down, a spin down, a spin down, and all six electrons are now paired in those lowest energy states. Yes.
Does this transition arise because of the changes in the energy level, or is there something else going on?
It arises because of the change in the energy level.
And that's the only thing that this determines the transition.
I think so. I mean, it's energy. Yeah, I mean, you have we've lowered the energy, right? Yeah, there's so many.
Why doesn't it start that way?
Oh, because here at low pressure, these energy levels are lower than these ones. Yeah. So it's still behaving like it should. It wants to take the least energy, right? There's another one.
So when you're referring to energy, what exactly are you talking about? Is these the kinetic energy of these electrons, or the energy it takes to bond an electron to the?
Yeah, no. So this isn't kinetic energy. I mean, the electrons aren't moving. I mean, with all of the energies, so like the whole enthalpy of the whole system is going to be lower here in this sort of low spin version as compared to this high spin version when we increase pressure. Is that what it, maybe, maybe?
You could say if an electron jump between these energy levels, it would give off a certain frequency of light, it would be related to that energy.
Like photoelectric effect or something?
Isn't that basically then the kinetic energy of the electron? I mean, you say it's not moving, but isn't it moving within a cloud?
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. There's another question about Jit.
Where's the second microphone, by the way? All right, good.
just trying to answer the question you raised. So basically those, as I understand, it's three energy levels, like so-called orbitals. And orbitals, it's basically, if you write a Schrodinger equation, it's those phi. And to get those energy, you basically solve Schrodinger equation, those phi, as you said, those the clouds, once you solve it, this is the energy for all. It's not only including the kinetic energy. It can include like potential energy or magnetic energy, all the energy together.
Everything.
Yeah. So it's not only about kinetic energy.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know if it's helpful, but as a seismologist, I like to think of it as like a gravity well. So, of course, there's no gravity, but here you have electrostatic forces, and so there's a potential well, and so there's an energy associated with the orbit at which, you know, where you're orbiting that potential well,
right?
Where you are in the potential well.
Sure. So we want to try to minimize that energy in that potential well. We want to be at the bottom. Okay. So all right. So when this occurs, as showed in the previous figure, the ionic radius decreases its size. Okay. So I show that here. So this is like the relative difference in size of the ionic radii. Here are what those orbitals look like. Okay, so here are the lobes in which the electrons can move around, orbit. Okay, all right. So the other thing I wanted to point out is that this is for, so we're just looking at these valence electrons, these final six electrons. That's what, you know, is being placed here. Now this is for Fe2+. Now if we were looking at Fe3+, okay, then we would have five d electrons instead of six d electrons. Okay, so you would only have five to sort of sort out here. Okay, so what about now, how do our elements now sort of coordinate themselves around each other? Okay, so we're going to define here a coordination number, and that is the number of nearest neighbors. So here we have our cation surrounded by its two anions. It makes a nice linear shape, so it's got two nearest neighbors, so its coordination number is 2. Here, this atom ion here is connected to 3 nearest neighbors. This tetrahedral coordination forms a tetrahedron. Okay, it's got 1, 2, 3, 4 nearest neighbors. This one's got 6 nearest neighbors. Okay, so this is octahedral shape, forming this sort of this octahedron. And then finally, we have here something with a coordination number of 8. Okay, so it's got 8 nearest neighbors. So let's look at some examples of this kind of coordination. Okay, so for the tetrahedral, this fourfold coordination, okay, silica, quartz. So the silicon is in the middle, surrounded by 4 oxygens. It's probably something you've all seen, held. Now, this tetrahedral shape, though, becomes very important when we start talking about silicates more generally. Okay. So if we look at this kind of little pyramid shape, we can then attach them together or not. Okay? So we can form chains. Okay, so here each of these tetrahedrons are attached to each other at their corners. Okay, so these chains, this would be like a pyroxene. You can then put those chains together. An amphibole would be an example of that. You can make sheets out of these chains. Sheets out of these tetrahedra. Okay, and then finally, you could leave them isolated from each other. Okay, so in olivine or in garnet, the silicon tetrahedra are not touching each other. Okay, as compared to these chain or sheet type minerals. Now the other common, shape or coordination that we see are in these octahedra. Okay, so we have here an example of periclase. Ferropericlase would also work with this. Okay, so we have a magnesium surrounded by 6 oxygens. Okay, so we can look at that here. So like, if this red one was a magnesium, then it's got 4 oxygens in plane with itself, and then 1 above it and 1 below it. Okay, so those are its nearest neighbors. Okay, this structure is also the sodium chloride structure, which we'll also come back to in a bit. Here are some other ways that we can see these octahedra present. So we went from ferropericlase And now we can see here, this is an octahedra, a silicon octahedra. So instead of having a silicon tetrahedra that we saw in the quartz and the olivine and the garnet and the micas and the amphiboles and pyroxenes and so forth, in bridgmanite, the silicon is instead surrounded by six oxygens. Okay, so here are those tetrahedra shown here. Or we can look at it in a slightly different manner. So here's the silicon in green surrounded by the oxygen, six oxygens that are in red. Okay. So now that we have these octahedra and tetrahedra, how do they actually fit into making the crystal itself? Okay. And what do those crystals look like? Excuse me. All right, so there are seven different lattice systems. Here are the first three. So I start off with the lowest symmetry. We've got triclinic. Triclinic means none of the lattice parameters, A, B, or C, are equal to each other, and none of the angles between them are also not equal to each other. Okay, so there's not a lot of symmetry going on here. Okay. As we kind of increase, as we increase symmetry, we've got monoclinic. So in this case, we have one of the angles is not equal to, it was not orthogonal, it's not equal to 90 degrees. And we also don't have one of the lattice parameters also doesn't equal with the others. Orthorhombic, all the angles are 90 degrees, so we've got something that is, as the name would suggest, orthogonal. All of the lattice edges are orthogonal to each other, but none of them have equal value. And we go on. There's tetragonal, rhombohedral, hexagonal, and then cubic. And here are just information about their lattice parameters and angles. Okay, so I started from the lowest symmetry to the highest symmetry. Now when I'm going to actually visualize them, we'll go from the high symmetry down to the low symmetry. Okay, so for the cubic, there are a number of different flavors of cubic. Okay, so we've got the simple cubic, so here's your box with atoms at each corner. We have a body-centered cubic, so we've got another atom that's stuck in the middle of that box. And then we have a face-centered cubic with atoms stuck on each of the faces of that cube. Okay, so this is what it would look like in various ways to display them. Okay, and here are the unit cells for each of them. Okay. Now, as examples, okay. So the simple cubic structure is a few examples of that. It's relatively rare in metals. Polonium is one of the metals that crystallizes in this simple cubic form. Okay. But if you have more than one element, you can actually form you can also use this simple cubic structure. For instance, the cesium chloride structure is basically a simple cube with simple cubes into them. So a simple cube of cesium with another simple cubic of the chlorine, shown in blue. The BCC, or the body-centered cubic, that lots of metals have this structure. Iron in particular, although as we increase pressure, the BCC form will change to a HCC form, and I'll show that soon. But other elements of note, lithium, sodium, potassium, and so forth, all share this same kind of structure. We have this body-centered cubic. And then finally, the last flavor of cubic, the face-centered cubic. Okay, so we have this sodium chloride, which is the same structure that the MgO crystallizes in. Okay, so we have, again, the so the red, that's the sodium, okay, in each of the faces here. And that's shown, again, with periclase, MgO. Now, as just a note, so in the Earth, we have a solid solution between MgO and FeO. So FeO is called wustite, and MgO is periclase. But when you do a, when you make a solid solution of the two, the name changes. So we can have ferropericlase as we add iron into the MgO, or if we come from the other way, and we're adding magnesium into the FeO, then we can call it magnesiowustite. Of course, when I was in graduate school, we just called it magnesiowustite for everything, even though it was probably technically we were always talking about a ferropericlase because this is where the Earth would lie. Okay, but if you see both of these, either of these terms, they may be talking exactly, you know, they could be talking about the same composition, just a change in fashion of sort of terminology. Okay. So there are also a lot of metals that crystallize in this FCC structure, so aluminum, copper, gold, platinum, silver. If you increase the temperature on iron at room pressure, you also get FCC structure. So it's a common metallic structure. Now, the other common metal structure is hexagonally close-packed, HCP. Okay, so we've got magnesium and beryllium and cadmium, titanium, that form this hexagonally close-packed structure. And then what we care most about is iron at high pressures. So iron in the inner core is likely to be in this HCP structure. Okay, so it's quite dense because it's you can fit a lot of, you have a good packing, a good packing density of your atoms here. It turns out that HCP, so the hexagonally close packed and the face-centered cubic, okay, are very similar and can be somewhat interchanged, well, kind of. So here we have, so how they differ is if you have here a layer of atoms, so they're all sort of sitting next to each other like such, and then you add a second layer or a B layer on top of it. So the blue one is now fitting kind of in the well in between the three here, and then that's then forming, you know, they're all sitting right up next to each other. For FCC, you would add another layer, a C layer, that is then looking like such, okay? Whereas the HCP layer would kind of just be ever so slightly different. Okay. Now, if you compare then, though, how much atoms you can stick in their respective boxes, whether that box be a cube or a hexagon polyhedron. Okay. What you find is, we can define this idea of a packing factor, okay, and that is the volume of the atoms, okay, the total volume of the atoms, that's all these spheres or parts of spheres, divided by the volume of the box it's sitting in. Okay. And when you do that for FCC and HCP, they have the same packing fraction. Okay, so this is the most efficient way to pack our atoms in. Why might that become important? Okay. If this is the most efficient way to pack things in, okay, this is going to be a very dense material, okay, as compared to something that doesn't pack the atoms in quite so nicely. Now, when we're dealing with pressure, high pressures, which is what we have in the interior of the Earth, right, we're going to start to tend to push things close together, if they let us, if the atoms let us. Because the atoms themselves, right, have electrons. And those electrons like to repel each other, okay? So we're going to have to worry about things like, you know, adding energy through the increase in pressure, we're basically adding energy to a system, right, that will then allow some of these structures to change, some of these crystal structures to change. That is what's happening with olivine as it's going into its various forms, ringwoodite and wadsite, and then finally into bridgmanite and ferropericlase. Okay, we're pushing these atoms closer and closer together. If we push them too close together, they will want to reorganize themselves, change their structure to make their electrons happy. Okay, and there's more. We'll try to run through these. Okay, so then if we don't want to close pack our hexagonal structure, we have just a plain hexagonal structure. The easiest one and the one we all know about is ice, the kind of ice that you find in your freezer. Ice 1H, the H stands for hexagonal. Okay. Here are the hexagons, you can kind of see them. You see the water molecules. So we have our little, what I like to call Mickey Mouse. So we have our hydrogen and our two oxygens. So we have the H2O, and they're all bonding like so. It's what gives the snowflakes their shape, okay, is the structure of this solid water, or ice 1H. Here are more examples. So we have a rhombohedral. Here's some calcite. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Actually, each of these, so we have here carbon surrounded by some oxygens, and you'll notice that's in that triangular shape coordination. So it's got three nearest neighbors. The carbon's got three nearest neighbors here. But the whole thing is, in turn, situated in this rhombohedral form. Okay, so all the lattice parameters are the same, but they have no orthogonal angles between them. Here's a tetragonal structure. This is a rutile, so we have titanium and our oxygen. And here we've got all orthogonal angles, and A and B are the same, C isn't. All right, so I'll spend a little bit more time on the next structure, the orthorhombic structure, because that's the one that's most important for deep earth mineralogy. Here I've got the most abundant minerals, all three of them of the earth, shown here, and they all happen to be orthorhombic. Okay, so we'll start off with olivine. Olivine is what's present at relatively low pressures. Here, the silicon is surrounded by four oxygens in their tetrahedra. Okay, and you've got your magnesiums in the orange. They are not connected. They don't touch each other. Okay. However, as we increase pressure, and I don't show the other the intermediate polymers, but what happens though when we go from olivine and this tetrahedra and we go to higher pressures, now the silicon has six nearest neighbors. Now those tetrahedra are now octahedra. Okay. Hopefully you can tell already that the packing density is much lower here than it is here, okay? And this is because of pressure. We're forcefully pushing these atoms together. Now, so as we have bergmanite, and then if we continue up to higher pressures, we can see now those octahedra now start to also kind of tilt, okay? And you get slightly different change in structure, although it still remains orthorhombic. Okay, so we've got, so again, our orthorhombic, none of the lattice parameters are the same, and all of the angles are orthogonal. Okay. Lower symmetry, we have monoclinic. So here we've got a nice pyroxene. Okay, and here is another silicate. This is orthoclase. Okay, so just some other not very high symmetry minerals. And then finally, the lowest symmetry minerals. Okay, this is a feldspar. Okay, and I just took off the wiki page because there's all different. There's a solid solution between the calcium aluminum anorthite N member and its sodium aluminum counterpart here, albite. So you can form many different flavors of this plagioclase depending on the relative abundances of the calcium versus sodium. Okay, and they look quite different, but they all share this low symmetry structure. And these are, you know, these are crustal rocks. Okay. All right, so now that we've shown some of the different crystal structures that these kinds of minerals can take, I'm going to introduce you to a few more rules that will hopefully clarify some of the reasons why these minerals have gone into their particular crystal structures. Okay, so we've got Pauling's rules. So we've had Hund's rules. We had the Pauli exclusion principle. Now we have Pauling, not to be confused with Pauli. Pauling's rules. Okay, so we've got four different rules here. I'll go through them individually. Okay, so the first rule has to do with the size of each of these cations. So the idea is that your cation can't be so small that it's going to be sort of rattle around within the other atoms. Okay? But it can't be so big that that you have you can't, so that there's no real connection. It can't be too big and it can't be too small. Okay, so for instance, this red cation is too small in this octahedral form. So there are actually six of the anions. We can think of them as oxygens, okay, surrounding this red cation. There's four here, and then there's one above it, and then one below it. So this would be not very stable, and so you'd want actually a slightly larger cation to fit in. Okay, this one is still okay, but if it gets to be too large, then it will also be not stable. So the way that we can organize these is we can look at the ratio between the size of the cation, that's the red one, as compared to the size of the anion, one of the blue ones. Okay. So in this six-fold coordination, so the has a six nearest neighbors, an octahedra. Okay. This is the smallest that the radius of the cation can be, is this 0.414. Okay, for the size. So if we, so that was just the six-fold coordinated system. So that was at 0.414, and it can go as large as 0.732. Notice none of these numbers go higher than 1. Generally, your cations tend to be smaller than your anions. Okay. but as you lose, as you go down in coordination number, the radius of your cation as with respect to the anion drops. Okay. And so these are all the different coordinations that I had shown earlier. Okay, so that's Pauling's first rule. Okay, you don't want to have your anions rattling around in the crystal, and you don't want it to be so big that there's not enough attraction between the atoms. Now the second rule that is proposed is this idea that you have, so if we're going to look at those electrostatic attraction and repulsion, okay, those are, that is going to, you can think of that in terms of like a strength of the bond there, okay, that attractive, like Coulombic type of force, okay, and that would be, so this bond strength is going to be larger when you have a higher cation charge because you have more electrons, okay? But that's going to be divided by the number of, or the coordination number, which is the number of nearest neighbors that you have. Okay, so if you have a large cation, but with a relatively low coordination number, then the strength of that bond is going to be high. Okay. Third rule. Now let's share these polyhedra. So these are those tetrahedrons that I showed earlier. So we can think of this as the silicon with four oxygens surrounding it. So in olivine, we have these tetrahedra that are isolated. They're not attached to each other. However, you can attach to each other. And if you're sharing these corners, that's stable, okay, as compared to, say, sharing edges here or sharing a face. Okay, so of these three configurations, it's much less stable to touch faces together rather than corners. And the reason is because when you're touching the faces of this tetrahedra together, your cation, so like say the silicon here and here, are close to each other, are at the closest place that they're going to be, that they will repel each other because of their protons. Okay, so this is less stable than say this configuration, where your silicons there and there are further apart. Okay, so there are actually some numbers on here. That's a 1.0. In this configuration, when they're sharing an edge, that's at 0.58, and then this distance here, where they're sharing a face, at 0.38. So that distance has gotten really close. So then you get repulsion between the cations. So if in your high pressure, you're pushing your tetrahedron or your octahedron together, and they start touching, this might be okay. But as you get them to start touching like this or like this, then those are they're not too happy in this manner, and will likely change their structure. Okay. All right, and finally, what happens when we start putting in cations that are different? So not just MgO. What if we now replace the magnesium for iron? Or in the case of the feldspar example I showed earlier, where you had calcium versus sodium, what do you do then? Okay, so if you have different cations, you have, you know, if you have ones that have large valence, so 3+ or 4+, say, okay, large charge, and small coordination, they're not going to share those polyhedra. They're not going to touch. Okay, so for olivine, okay, for olivine, that's what happens in olivine, right? Our tetrahedra are not touching each other. They're isolated. Okay, so what about other cations that have similar size? Okay, so if we have, so in one of the early Pauling rules, right? You don't want your cation to be rattling around. It just kind of got to fit in there nicely, right? So if you normally would have, say, a magnesium in a particular site, you want to be able to find something that is similar in size to it so that it won't rattle around or be too big. Okay? So for magnesium, so if here's just some carbonates, here for the larger cations, so potassium is quite a large cation. This is a bit, I mean, this is actually quite big. Okay. As it turns out, you can get these to replace each other, but this is actually going to require temperature. That will come up in a little bit, okay? Because their differences between the two is quite large, right? This radius is significantly larger than this one. You know, some 30+%. Okay. What else? Okay. So anyway, so if we're going to be making any sort of substitutions in our minerals, we want to think about size. One of the things we need to worry about is size, and charge. Okay. So there's some more rules to do all of this. Okay, so now we have Goldschmidt's rules. Okay, so what do you propose? Right, you can have these similarly sized cations, and they should be able to substitute for each other as long as they're not too big. Okay, or not too big or not too small. So this is size difference. Okay, so if it's less than 15% different, that could be 15% smaller or 15% larger, up to 15% larger, then you can freely substitute. If it's slightly larger than that, say up to 30%, maybe you can substitute. But if it's greater than 30%, then it's really hard to make any sort of substitution. Okay, so if it's 30% larger or smaller than what it's replacing, it's not gonna happen. Okay. Now the other thing we have to worry about besides size, though, is we also have to worry about the keeping this mineral charge neutral. Okay, so it's okay. We can, replace something that is 2+ to say 3+. That is okay. We can do it, but it's much harder to replace one atom, one ion for another that has a much different difference in valence electrons. So this is, you know, one electron as compared to three. OK, Okay, so this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen very often. This you can do. Okay, so we have to worry about size and charge. All right, and then finally, so we have the size of the ion, and we have the charge of the ion. Okay, so this is going to set up a this bonding between the force between the between what it's going into and itself. Of course, since you have charge, you're going to have the attractive or repulsive, the Coulomb forces, okay? But then the size of it also matters, as we've been discussing this morning, okay? So we can define now this ionic potential, okay, which is a difference, the ratio between the charge, okay, as compared to the radius of that ion. Okay, so this potential, ionic potential, is higher when you've got lots of electrons, okay, or a very small ion. Okay, so this is this idea of this ionic potential. So if you have, an ion that has higher charge, but same, so you had a choice between two ions, and yet they were of similar size, but one had more charge. The one that has higher charge is going to enter the crystal because it'll have higher ionic potential. Okay. Now, of course, there are always going to be caveats to these rules, and so the caveat to Goldschmidt's rules was proposed here by Ringwood. Okay. And he said, even if you've satisfied all those rules, like the charge is okay, the size is okay, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get substitution. Okay. And the reason why you may not get substitution, even if your charge is okay and your size is okay, is because when you have ions that have very different electronegativities. Okay, so the example would be sodium, which has sodium is just one electron, one valence electron, and copper, also a 1+. Okay, they have similar radii, they have the same charge, but you don't get copper, replacing for sodium in, say, a feldspar. Okay. And the reason for that is because their electronegativities are quite different. So this is the periodic table again, but now the numbers that are shown on here is the electronegativity value for them. So sodium here has a relatively low value of electronegativity at below 1. Okay. Copper, on the other hand, is more than double that. Okay. Normally when we think of electronegativity, we think of like the attraction between, like, say, sodium and chlorine, right? Or these ones are highly electronegative. The chlorines, the fluorines, and so forth. But because sodium and copper have very different electronegativities, you're not going to see substitution between them, even though they followed all the previous rules. Okay, so this is just kind of a side note that was shown. Okay, so we have now a bunch of rules, and they all sort of run around size and charge and okay, right? But what happens when your charge changes? Okay, so this is sulfur, and sulfur has lots of different oxidation states. Okay, and here, to scale, okay, is if you have a sulfur 2-, okay, so it's lacking 2 electrons, it's very large, okay, as compared to, say, sulfur here, okay, 6 plus, which is very small. Okay, so if so, the valence state of your element is going to change the size of your cation. Temperature also can affect the size of the cation. As I was saying before, like, you know, potassium and sodium, they're very different in size, you know, like 30% plus 30%, or here 25%, but I think that's bigger than 25%. Anyway, it's large. It's a large difference. However, when you increase the temperature, right, these ionic radii also increase. And it turns out that you can get these so that they're not as different in size, and so substitution can occur. So it'll be within that sort of 15 to 30% size difference at high temperatures. And so it's only at high temperatures will you get this substitution, okay, the sodium for potassium. Sorry.
Let me ask a question.
So, and that's why let's say granite cools down, then we get exsolution textures in like pertite textures.
Yeah. So you definitely can. This will be able to start to tell you like when things, like the temperatures when things started to crystallize. Yeah. Because then if it's too cold, right? You don't get that. So it depends on how fast things are cooling, yeah, and the temperatures at what they happen.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's see. Okay, so if all the rules were followed and there weren't sort of weird electronegativity problems and so forth, we can start making some substitutions. Okay. So let's look at very common substitution in the deep earth. That's replacing a magnesium for an iron. They both have 2 plus in this case. So for MgO periclase, N-member FeO, wustite, you can form this solid solution, no problem. Okay? They have identical charges. They have similar enough sizes. They're happy to be together. Okay. Likewise for the olivine system, so we have here the magnesium N-member forsterite and phaolite, okay, and they too are happy to do a substitution. Okay. So this would be an easy way to do a substitution. Now it gets a little bit more complicated, but it can be done. All right, you can have a coupled substitution. Okay, so when in coupled substitution, that's when you're trying to change, you're trying to replace ions that don't have the same charge. Okay, so for instance, here we have a calcium 2 plus and an aluminum 3 plus, and they're going to go in and switch out for the sodium, which has just one electron, and the silicon, which has 4 electrons. Note that it's still balanced charge-wise, right? We have a total of 5 charges here and a total of 5 charges here. So the way that this can work, even if, you know, calcium and sodium don't have the same charge, right? We said that we can still do this if they don't have the same charge, but they have to, we can do it relatively easily because we are keeping the whole system neutral, right? So the calcium is going to replace for the sodium in the same site, but the aluminum is going to go into the silicon site, and despite it also not having the same kind of charge. Now this happens in bridgmanite, this kind of substitution. I think I have that it's on the next slide. So this is, you know, this example is for something not really relevant for the deep earth, but we have here the albite, anorthite, end members. Okay, so what if instead we want to look at bridgmanite? Okay, so in bridgmanite, This is just one one particular substitution mechanism. So in the same manner, so this idea of charge coupled substitution, we can have an aluminum 3+, an aluminum 3+, and this would be in the six-fold coordinate site, which is the so the six-fold versus the eight-fold coordinated site. Okay, so this is the silicon site. That's the silicon octahedra. Okay, replacing for this silicon, and then the other aluminum replacing the magnesium in its site. Okay, again we have charge balance, so everything is kosher. Okay. Now the other mechanism that had been proposed for putting aluminum into the bridgmanite structure would be by what's called oxygen vacancy substitution, or more generally this omission substitution. Okay, and that's where we can take our two aluminums that is going to go into the silicon site. This is the silicon octahedra. Okay, and an oxygen vacancy. Okay, so we're going to take out an oxygen and replace two silicons with two aluminums. So in order for this to be charge balance, one of those oxygens have to go away. Okay, so that's why it's called an oxygen vacancy here. So we're omitting the oxygen. And you could do this, this can happen in other systems, but I choose this as the sort of one that's more relevant.
And what would be the options for
where that oxygen would go? I mean, whether it's, you know, it doesn't book a flight and go to town.
It turns out that this isn't energetically very favorable.
I mean, is the idea that
it could involve other minerals, or I mean, I'm just guessing, at getting a sense of what are its options as far as making this happen.
And maybe Lars can remind me, but so there have been calculations that have looked at these two things, and this becomes at high pressures where bridgmanite is the stable phase. This is not favored at all. It's energetically unfavorable. So while I can write it like this, it's not going to happen over that. Yeah. Okay. Now, if instead of replacing one cation for another, so replacing a magnesium and an iron for an aluminum or silicon or what have you, what if we just place an atom, an ion, in a hole, interstitially? Okay. So this actually happens, okay, so for not a deep earth mineral, but as an example, so this is beryl. Okay. This is what it looks like, and you can see it's got these nice holes. Okay, so these silicon tetrahedra, okay, are making these nice sort of channels in this crystal structure. Okay. And so what can happen then is then you can start filling those holes with other, you know, things that will fit quite nicely in there. So here you have potassium or any of these alkali metals. It has to be coupled though to save have to couple it with something else, right? So that you have charge balance here, the 4+, 3+, and the 1+. So we're going to take that all, and this is kind of where I end. Okay, so here, taking all of the kind of the rules about size and charge, electronegativity, what pressure and temperature and, I don't know what happened to my pressure slide. Okay, what happens to these cations as you increase pressure? I don't know where my slide went. I'm just realizing that didn't show up. What happens to the ionic radii as we increase pressure? What do you think? It should shrink, right? Okay, so as they shrink, and they shrink, and they will shrink again if they do sort of if there's any spin transitions and so forth, right? That means then we have to keep these things in check, because they still have to follow these rules, right? If they become, so something that may not have been able to fit into a crystal structure because it was really large, say like a really fluffy potassium or a fluffy calcium and so forth, they're very large, but they're, as we increase pressure, they become smaller and smaller. And so then they might be able to fit in to structures that they may not have been able to fit in at normal conditions. Okay, so those are sort of the things that we can kind of keep in mind, and we're still holding all these rules that we have that we've learned about today, in that we have to keep we have to remember that our pressure, our temperature, our valence state is all going to affect those sizes, and that's what's going to be a big player in these substitution. Yes.
Can you be more quantitative about what you mean by fluffy?
Oh yeah, sure.
I don't know if I want that on record.
Okay,
it,
so
it sounds like it's got an important thing. The different ions are going to have different compressibilities, effectively.
Right. So just showing this as, so here's our magnesium and iron and so forth. They're kind of small-ish as compared to these alkali metals or alkali earth metals. These are kind of fluffy, big. Right. These are big. You wouldn't. So depending on the coordination of the crystal structure that you're trying to fit your say a calcium into, it may not fit in because it's larger, right? It's more than 25% larger than say the magnesium.
If you increase the pressure, it doesn't. Not everything shrinks uniformly.
Exactly.
That's the point.
Right. Exactly. So they don't shrink. They don't shrink uniformly. These tend to shrink faster. Okay. With increasing pressure, and so then you can get into the realm of it being okay to substitute. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
Can you go to your last slide you just had? So I do understand that there are like certain configurations, but I guess I'm surprised that there's these so few jumps, at least. Like, I'm surprised that most of the mantle is bridgmanite and that there's not more of a gradient between many different minerals. Why is that?
Well, okay, so this is also quite simplified, and this is based on a single starting composition. Okay, so this is a pyrolite or a pyritite type composition. Are you wondering, because maybe why we see heterogeneities? This looks pretty.
It's because bridgmanite is just a set crystal structure. Mm-hmm. So why is, I guess, there's not a more stable mineral assembly, or not mineral assembly, a more stable structure at 2,600 kilometers versus 670 kilometers?
Yeah, so that's where this post-perovskite comes in. So this becomes at the highest pressures more stable than this one.
It depends on the
PT and composition, the pressure, temperature, and the composition. But so this is kind of generically put in here as that's what this. So bridgmanite does become less favorable here.
I guess what I'm just expressing surprise that for the majority of the mantle. The bridgmanite structure is the most stable, and there's not any change at all. I guess. guess it is what it is.
I have a comment for that. Yeah. If you actually go to the literature and Google search props guide, you will find that there is a huge amount of literature in material science. Props guide structure is known to be really flexible, so you can accommodate range of different compositions, very weird metals and noble metals and huge size. My way to look at it is that it has structural component that is flexible, which is octahedral tilting. So Kanani and Isley show one of the diagrams that the props guide can accommodate different range of tilting of octahedron, one that's straight up to very tilted like this. And that flexibility is, to me, is a secret for the large stability field of bridgmanite. And that's why it has huge stability field. That was the reason why the post-props guide transition was surprising to many of us, because we thought bridgmanite will probably stay stable down to the lowermost mantle, but you know, it didn't actually. But it itself have the flexibility that is very difficult to find in other minerals. So that's, different people may have different way to look at or explain the stability, but that's at least my way of look at the remarkable stability.
Thank you. Lars, did you want to add to that?
I was going to make the same point.
Okay, good. Can you pass the...
So if we have two materials, one is FCC, the other one is HCP, and if we continuously squeeze them, will they change the structure to each other? I mean, the FCC one will change to HCP, or HCP one will change to FCC?
So they're at the sort of the highest packing fraction. I mean, if you push them, so close together. I'm just trying to think. So iron. So iron at high temperature, and anyone who knows better. So iron at high temperature some pressure forms FCC, but at the at sort of the temperatures that we think like the Earth's core would be at, it's HCP instead of say FCC or even BCC, although that is controversial. I'm not hopefully not offending anybody in this room. In that example, it looks like it's HCP, but I don't know if that was the answer that you were looking for, Lars.
Right. So as Kanani showed, the packing fraction of FCC and HCP are identical, and so you can't really choose one or the other based on any simple packing fraction arguments about one or the other being more stable at high pressure. And so it comes down to very subtle effects. What Kanani also showed is that FCC and HCP only differ in the third layer, ABC versus ABAB. And so you have to look at electronic interactions between second nearest neighbors. So very subtle things. Mm-hmm. So in iron, as Kanani was saying, you go from BCC to FCC to HCP with increasing pressure. If you go to higher pressures beyond what you get in the earth, you go back to FCC again. FCC mm-hmm. appears at like 100 times the pressure at the center of the earth. And then BCC appears again at like 1,000 times the pressure in the center of the earth. So there are very subtle effects. Another way of seeing these subtle effects is to look at the crystal structures across the 3D transition metal series. And as you go across that series from scandium to zinc, you see BCC, FCC, and HCP, all of them, and not in any simple pattern. But you can actually rationalize the pattern based on the number of d electrons and a simple model of the electronic structure.
Thank you.
People are ready for lunch. Thanks, Kenan.
Yeah.